Good morning.
Good morning.
Wednesday morning, House Transportation, 8 a.m., April 25th. We've got a fairly full agenda today. We're going to work most of the bills that we've got on the agenda, including the work session on House Bill 2139. First off this morning, we've got a presentation scheduled from Ford Motor Company and the alternative fuel vehicle whole issue and idea is kind of the topic du jour today with House Bill. It kind of ties in nicely to House Bill 3946 this morning. We've got Scott Rulin here from Ford Motor Company. He's going to, have a PowerPoint presentation and among other things, and also Will Gonzalez. I'd like to welcome you to the committee this morning.
Thank you very much for having us here today. Again, my name is Will Gonzalez. I'm the governmental affairs manager for Ford Motor Company here in Oregon. And what we're doing here today is just wanting to introduce ourselves to you all and some of our products, specifically our clean-burning alternative fuel vehicles. I want to just give you a kind of an overview of what we currently have, why we have it, and what we're working on for the future. I think a lot of you had the chance to come down and see some of these cars yesterday, and for those who didn't, I understand you guys had a late session, so we'll see what happens when we dim the lights. We have a presentation with all our products. So I'll turn it over to Scott Rulin.
Thank you. My name is Scott Rulin. I handle the alternative fuel marketing for Ford Motor Company on the West Coast, which obviously includes Oregon, all the way up to Washington, down to Arizona, California, and Nevada. I'll just start through the presentation here. Ford Motor Company is not new to alternative fuels. We've been in the business for over 30 years. We've had some medium-duty propane trucks over the years and methanol programs and ethanol. And we currently offer vehicles that run on compressed natural gas, propane, ethanol, and electricity.
Yeah.
And I'd also like to point out the fact that all of our gasoline vehicles are getting cleaner as well. All of our SUVs and all of our F-Series pickups meet the low emission vehicle standard in all 50 states, which is ahead of the mandates required by EPA. Some of the questions that come up, why would somebody go with alternative fuel vehicles? Well, the main reason is clean air. Obviously, different regions throughout the country have air quality problems, and automotive or mobile sources are a huge contender, contributor to the air quality problems. EPAC, the Energy Policy Act, compliance with that act is another reason to go to alternative fuels. The EPAC requires that state fleets and fuel provider fleets purchase 75% of their light-duty vehicles be alternative fuel. That basically means any vehicle under 8,600 pounds, 75% of those purchases on an annual basis need to be something other than gasoline or diesel. And all of our alternative fuels qualify for EPAC compliance. Reduces dependency on foreign oil, potential fuel cost savings with the cost of natural gas. Historically, has been about a third cheaper than gasoline, and they are reliable and as safe, if not safer, than gasoline products. The Crown Victoria was our first dedicated natural gas vehicle, built 100% in the factory. I mentioned it is dedicated. It uses the V8 engine. By dedicated, it does not have any gasoline. It's strictly compressed natural gas. In certain states, the HOV, the carpool access lane in California, there's some special decals you put on the vehicle and allows you to go in the carpool lane with just the driver. So there's some side benefits to driving an alternative fuel vehicle other than just the clean air. The tanks in the Crown Victoria, I won't spend a whole lot of time on this, we'll be changing this tank design for next year to provide up to 18 or 19 gallons of fuel capacity. That'll get the vehicle probably 350 miles. And range is a concern, driving distance is a concern on alternative fuel vehicles, typically because the tank storage systems are different than you have with gasoline, so typically you don't have as many gallons on the vehicle. So range becomes an issue, and a factor of range is where the fuel stations are. So those are some of the issues that I get involved with almost on a daily basis.
What's the current situation as far as your fueling stations? Are there fueling stations that are set up to handle these kinds of compressed natural
gas? There are, and it varies from state to state and region to region. I'm more familiar with the infrastructure in California for natural gas, and there's over 110 public access fuel stations that are 24 hours a day. Here in Oregon, I don't think there's more than about half a dozen stations, and I don't know how many of those are public access. A lot of them are just fleet only, like the transit district here, I don't believe allows anybody else to use their station.
The stations that are in California, let's just talk about California. Huh? That's where you're familiar, and that's where this, I think you're farther headed there.
Yeah.
Has there been a public subsidy in order to, you know, get these things up and running?
There's a lot of grant money that comes from the Department of Energy through Clean Cities, the Clean Cities program. And I believe Portland is a designated clean city. There is some state money from the California Energy Commission. CARB has appropriated some funds to go towards infrastructure. And Ford Motor Company has even stepped up to the plate and provided co-funding to help put in fuel stations that will help us put fleet vehicles into service. We concentrate primarily around airports and other locations where we can get some high-volume fleet applications. And if it takes Ford stepping up to the plate to make a fuel station happen to allow us to put some more product on the ground, we've been known to do that. This is a dedicated F-150 pickup truck, best-selling pickup truck in the world. We have it available as a dedicated natural gas as well as a bi-fuel. A bi-fuel operates on natural gas or propane as the primary fuel. When it runs out, it switches back to gasoline. Basically, the bi-fuels are gasoline trucks with a second fuel system on them that allow them to actually burn cleaner when they're burning the alternative fuel. On the dedicated truck, and we had this truck parked outside yesterday, there are two tanks in the bed and one tank underneath. And the range on this vehicle is up to 300 miles. On the bi-fuel truck, we actually have a couple of options. You can get the regular cab or the super cab and two- and four-wheel drive. We have found that the bi-fuel vehicles have a lot more applications than the dedicated do, primarily because of the lack of infrastructure. These vehicles go approximately 150 miles on natural gas, and then they can run on gasoline until they can refuel at a natural gas fuel station, or propane for that matter. But the vehicles are specifically natural gas bi-fuel or propane bi-fuel. And all the bi-fuels include gasoline. On the propane trucks, we actually have a second tank option here. This tank is larger in diameter than these two. These two tanks allow you to put a toolbox across the back of the bed. In fact, Caltrans in California bought 350 of these trucks last year. In addition, they bought some larger trucks, which I have on the next slide here. This is our Super Duty line of trucks. It's a chassis cab. Basically, you can put any body or bed on this type of truck that you desire to meet your application needs. We've got a couple of different fuel tank configurations on propane. It does meet the ULEV emission ratings, which is ultra low emission vehicle standards, and that's in all 50 states. We also have our full-size vans. These are available in both the passenger configuration as well as a cargo van. These are dedicated natural gas. They meet the ULEV standard, emission standard, that and also meet SULEV in California, which is super ultra-low emission vehicle standards. As I mentioned, we've got several options on the vans. We've got a couple of different 8, 12, and 15-passenger configurations. And on the 8-passenger, we actually have an additional tank that's mounted inside the vehicle that allows this vehicle to go well over 300 miles. In fact, last summer, I drove one of these vans with my family from L.A. to San Francisco and didn't have a problem. It was on 4th of July weekend even, and we didn't have an issue running out of fuel or just making it up there. This is our primary focus for this type of vehicle is the door-to-door shuttle market, primarily focusing on airports. Once again, airports provide a high concentration of high-mileage vehicles. It's a good place for fuel stations to be because you've got the taxis, the shuttles, rental car companies. There's a lot of vehicles that just circulate right around the airport. If there's a local fuel station, it can really add to the whole equation. This is a new product that Ford's offering this year. This is a product that the industry has been clamoring for. It's a medium-duty E450 cutaway. It can be set up as either a shuttle bus, as shown in the bottom picture here, or it can be set up as a cargo delivery vehicle with just a big box on the back of it. Primary applications for this type of vehicle, hotel, rental car applications, as I mentioned, we're focusing on airports, chartered transportation, paratransit with ADA wheelchair accessible types of equipment, and then cargo delivery. I won't bore you with too many details on this. The short story on this is that it meets the extremely clean half-gram NOx, that's nitrogen oxides, in California, or it meets ULEV in the 49 states. So it is very clean for the size vehicle. We also have a lead-acid battery electric Ranger. These are available in limited supplies this year. You may or may not know Ford is supplying 500 postal delivery vehicles in the state of California. And basically, those postal delivery vehicles are an electric Ranger with a different body on them. So we're really trying to focus on that postal contract and make sure that that's a success. The Think City, this was, I guess, the vehicle that got the second most attention yesterday. We had the fuel cell out there that I think most people got an opportunity to get in and drive and look at. The Think City will be available springtime next year. Retail price is targeted about $18,000. It's a two-seat battery electric vehicle with a range of approximately 50 miles. And some of the markets that we're targeting with this are closed communities, campuses, large manufacturing facilities where they might have need for vehicles to be driven inside the factories and those sorts of applications. And it does have plastic panels on the body, but it does have an aluminum subframe to allow it to pass the crash standards. This vehicle pictured here was built in Norway. The ones that will be sold here in the United States, or leased here in the United States, will be slightly redesigned to meet our federal motor vehicle safety standards. The Think Neighbor is, I guess, the smaller sister vehicle to the Think City. This is not a golf cart. Might sort of look like one, but people from Think get a little upset if you call it a golf cart. Technically, it's a low-speed vehicle, and some of the requirements of a low-speed vehicle are that it not exceed 25 miles per hour. They are legal on roads that are posted 35 miles an hour or less. You can see it has all the turn signals, headlights, safety glass on the windshield, three-point seat belts. So it really is a complete vehicle, and we do have door side panels that are available and heating and air conditioning as well. And this should be available, or will be available, approximately in August. To talk about what's coming down the pike, I just pretty much covered everything that we currently have available. Ford has announced that in 2003 we'll have a gasoline-electric hybrid based on our new SUV, the Escape, and it's estimated to get 40 miles to the gallon. Now, once again, this will operate on gasoline. It's just a high fuel economy vehicle or drivetrain. The P2000, this is the Think fuel cell that was outside yesterday. It is a hydrogen fuel cell vehicle. It's fueled with compressed hydrogen. The fuel cell converts the hydrogen, adds it with oxygen, and creates electricity to drive the electric motor. So basically, a fuel cell vehicle, in short, is an electric vehicle with its own onboard charging system, if you will. The drivetrain, in terms of the motor and the controller, are basically the same as what you would have in a battery electric vehicle. But with a battery electric, you have to plug it in for anywhere from 6 to 8 hours to get it to charge. This vehicle, you pull up to a hydrogen fuel station, which there aren't too many of those around right now, but you pull up to a fuel station, you fuel the vehicle, and it'll charge itself by the process that the fuel cell uses to convert that hydrogen back to electricity. So, a couple other things about this particular vehicle. This was the first fuel cell vehicle that Ford Motor Company built. I think it was one of the first fully functional vehicles in the world. It does have an all-aluminum body. It looks like a Ford Contour, but it's actually It has a longer wheelbase, and it's all aluminum. So there's a lot of technology built into this vehicle other than just the power source and the drivetrain. And for those of you that drove it, you may or may not know it, but you drove roughly a $6 million vehicle.
Oh, my gosh.
This is another version of a fuel cell vehicle, FC5. And my understanding is that this vehicle, we've gone through several generations of fuel cell vehicles. This one has already been superseded by some new technologies that they're working on. This one in particular is fueled with methanol. There's a device called the reformer that basically pulls hydrogen out of a source fuel. You can use natural gas, you can use methanol, you can use gasoline, and basically this reformer will extract the hydrogen and then use that hydrogen in the hydrogen fuel cell. But the issue with that is you no longer have a zero emission vehicle because you've got these byproducts from the source fuel after you've extracted that hydrogen. So they use different methods of catalytic converters like we currently have in our gasoline vehicles to reduce those emissions as low as they can. And one of the biggest challenges right now for the future of fuel cell vehicles is what is that source fuel? They can use gasoline, but then it's almost defeating the purpose because it's not a zero emission vehicle any longer. And the fact that the hydrogen, the P2000 vehicle, this is truly a zero emission vehicle. There's two tailpipes, plastic tailpipes on this vehicle, and just a little steam comes out. So basically the byproduct is water, it's distilled water. But the problem with this is there's no place to get hydrogen. There's two stations that were just put in California, one in Sacramento where the California Fuel Cell Partnership is located, and then one out in Palm Springs where the transit agency is running some fuel cell buses, and they have a lot of other alternative fuel programs going on there. So infrastructure, once again, is the main issue in terms of what the source fuel is. So that's something that will probably be played out in the next, I'd say, 3 to 5 years. 2004 is when Ford expects to come to the market with a fuel cell vehicle. We'll be targeting specific fleet applications, limited availability, and we'll slowly roll it out. I don't know what the projected volumes are after 2004, but we're going to do some controlled tests with fleets when we first introduce the product.
Is that true?
Yes. That's from Berkeley.
Thank you. I did enjoy driving this $6 million vehicle. Thank you for that opportunity.
Thank you for driving it safely.
I'm not sure quite what would have happened had it not been a safe trip around the block. But in terms of the hydrogen, and I love this fuel cell technology, but the total picture of the pollution, if you will, has to include the pollution that comes from the generation of electricity that is used to create the hydrogen as well.
Sure.
We have to kind of broaden out that circle in order to understand the impact of a...
Mm-hmm. One thing that we look at when we look at alternative fuel vehicles is upstream emissions. With gasoline vehicles, you've got everything from the refineries to the transportation of the fuel, the transfer into the truck to the tank at the fuel station, and then finally when you put that nozzle into your tank, there's vapors escaping. So those aren't tailpipe emissions, but it's all related to you burning gasoline in your vehicle. With natural gas, basically all in the pipeline, it's compressed at a fuel station, it's put in your vehicle, and it's a sealed system. There's no venting or anything, so there's no evaporative emissions that come from dedicated natural gas vehicles. So there's already a gain on emissions or reduction of emissions with dedicated compressed natural gas vehicles over gasoline. And then the tailpipe emissions are cleaner as well. So there's almost a double dip there to reduce total emissions. And when it comes to the fuel cell issue with hydrogen, I mentioned that there is a hydrogen station in the Palm Springs area at the transit agency. They actually use solar energy to convert water, mm-hmm. to separate it to hydrogen and oxygen. So it's really a totally renewable energy source that is essentially free. So they hook the garden hose up to the system, they get hydrogen and oxygen, and then they have to compress the hydrogen, obviously, which there's some cost involved there, and then they put that directly into the vehicle. And there's obviously cost associated with a solar system large enough to produce a lot of hydrogen for transit buses. But they, I believe they got federal funds to basically pay for that whole system. And Ballard and a bunch of the other companies that are involved in the fuel cell side of the business basically gave them this bus to demonstrate out there. So those are all issues. When you look at the total energy source and total or energy usage and total emissions, I think that the compressed natural gas vehicles are probably some of the cleanest when you consider the total scope from, they call from wellhead to tailpipe. And I think that the hydrogen would probably be a close second, if not take that first place once they get a little more proficient in those types of systems.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Representative Brown has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I got two questions. Anybody that's ever seen the old movies of the Hindenburg disaster realizes how volatile hydrogen fuel is. When you put it into a car and it's involved in an accident, do you have the similar catastrophes like you had with the Hindenburg?
The short answer would be no, and I'll explain why. The fuel system, the storage system on a hydrogen vehicle is very similar to that of a natural gas vehicle, compressed natural gas vehicle. In compressed natural gas, the storage pressure is up to 3,600 psi, 3,000 to 3,600. The tanks themselves are, in many respects, bulletproof. They're capable of withstanding a pressure of 2.5 times the service pressure. So say a 3,000 PSI system, if for some reason the fuel station goes out of whack and it overpressurizes the vehicle, that tank is tested and designed to withstand 2.5 times that pressure. So it would be 7,500 PSI before that tank would rupture. Now, with natural gas, there's a very small window of where the air-to-fuel ratio is combustible. I've seen videos from tank manufacturers where they have a large flame right next to a tank that's venting natural gas, and it doesn't burn because there's not enough air, there's not enough oxygen in that gas. It's so dense coming out that there's no oxygen to allow it to burn. The area that would allow it to burn would be up at the outer edges of that cloud of natural gas where it's starting to mix with the oxygen. And if your flame source or ignition source is down, say at a vehicle with a battery arcing, the natural gas is lighter than air, as is hydrogen. It'll dissipate up into the air, and by the time that mixture is flammable, it's so far away from the ignition source that it will not burn. Now, there's other safety devices built in. That's just kind of the nature of the fuel. There's solenoid valves on the tanks, so in the event of an impact, those valves shut off to prevent any fuel from escaping from the tanks. I mentioned they're virtually bulletproof. They have shot. I've seen videos, once again, where they shoot bullets at these tanks that are pressurized, and depending on, I guess they just used a, 38 or something, and the bullets just bounced off, and the tank still held its pressure. Then they used an armor-piercing bullet, which punctured the tank, and it just vented, but it didn't blow up. So there's high-pressure safety cutoff devices at the tank. There's some upstream. There's low-pressure safety devices. So there's with the hydrogen vehicles, they actually have sensors that can detect leaks as well. So there's a lot of safety devices built into the fuel systems.
Second question, then, there's a lot of natural gas around, but how available is it to motorists, or would that be a lot of stations developed, or some way to access that natural gas?
As I mentioned earlier, I don't recall if you were seated at that point. The state of California, there's well over 100 public access fuel stations to get compressed natural gas. And that didn't happen overnight. That's been over, a 15-year period or so. Here in Oregon, I don't believe there's more than about half a dozen stations. I work closely with the gas utility folks who obviously have an interest in selling more natural gas. And it's really this, the natural gas industry, from the vehicle standpoint, is very much a partnership. It's a partnership between the auto companies who have the vehicles that burn the fuel, added to that, you have the gas utility companies, which in some cases, like in California with deregulation, can no longer sell, put in their own fuel stations to sell natural gas to the retail public. So now we have third-party fuel providers that actually come in and build fuel stations. Hypothetically, let's say the state of Oregon wanted to put in a natural gas fuel station at one of your city, facilities, maintenance facilities, and you had a plan to buy vehicles over the next several years to a quantity that would justify putting in your own station. There's companies that are in the business of putting in a station for you at no cost, and a station of that magnitude might cost $500,000. They would, if you provide the land, they'd come in, put in a fuel station for you. You'd have a fuel contract signed with them, so you could basically forecast what your fuel costs are going to be, and you would just buy vehicles. You have on-site fuel, and for your fleet vehicles, that wouldn't be an issue. Now, something that you could add to that, if you made that open to the public, then that could actually be a revenue source for the state by selling fuel to the public, whether it comes back to you in the form of cash or in a lower fuel cost for your own fleet, because of the fact you've got a hose going outside your facility to allow public access. So there's a lot of different ways that type of contract can be drafted between a fleet and one of these third-party fuel providers. And I don't get involved in those details. I try to bring all the parties together, find niches where our products fill the need, and just try to get everybody together in the same room.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I've got couple of last comments here. In terms of service and availability, one of the issues with alternative fuels is the unknown of how to work on them, how to service them, what happens if something goes wrong. All of Ford's products have the same warranty as our gasoline products, 3 years, 36,000 miles. And later this year, we will have an extended warranty plan available for the alternative fuel vehicles. We do have a network of authorized natural gas dealerships that are capable of selling and servicing these vehicles. They're built with the same reliability and durability as our gasoline products. And we can also provide free training for technicians. So it's a full support system. It's not just us building vehicles. We're there from the initial sales all the way to the point where you need repairs.
How soon is it, do you believe, that we will see the T2000, on Ford's production line?
What you'll see is probably a car based on the Focus as a fuel cell vehicle. 2004 is when we plan on doing these pilot projects. It could be as many as a couple to several years, maybe 3 years, 2 years after that, to the point where it's available to retail consumers. It's possible that, the state of Oregon could participate in one of these demonstration programs. I'm not close enough to that side of the business to be able to tell you one way or the other.
We're looking maybe in the next 8 to 10 years.
And until it's commercially available on a grand scale, perhaps. And the products will be fairly limited to the point where you're going to be looking at small passenger cars. If you're looking to replace all your medium-duty trucks, fuel cell probably isn't what you want to look at. And just to close, I'll mention some of the challenges that alternative fuel vehicles have and that the industry has. First and foremost, and we've been discussing it here, is infrastructure. Where do you fill them up? Both on natural gas and propane. Propane infrastructure is much less expensive to install because basically you just put in a tank with a little pump. And most propane companies are willing to put a tank in there for you and service you with propane. Whereas compressed natural gas is a much more complicated type of fuel station where you've got a compressor and lots of different valves and computerized controls. So there's a big cost difference between the two. Incremental cost on the vehicles can range anywhere from $3,000 to $5,000 for a car or a truck or a van from Ford. The shuttle bus that I showed earlier, incremental cost on that, depending on what tank package you want, we've got a couple of optional tanks that will extend the driving range, can be anywhere from $11,500 up to about $14,000 or $15,000. probably the biggest challenge is the lack of incentives and funding to help customers and fleets buy these vehicles. As I cover several different states, I see a lot of different approaches to incentives and funding when it comes to offsetting this incremental cost, all the way from you know, the local air quality management districts offering $3,000 for somebody to buy a dedicated natural gas vehicle. And basically what they're doing, they're using that money to buy emission reductions. They don't offer that money for the biofuel vehicles, but the infrastructure in the LA South Coast Basin is substantial enough where you don't need a biofuel option on the vehicle. You can get away with just a dedicated natural gas vehicle. So the air district there is buying emission reductions by only providing incentives to these dedicated products. Up in the Bay Area, they've got other programs there where they fund only government agencies through the Bay Area Air Quality Management District. They've got different sets of funding for natural gas vehicles versus electric vehicles, and there's just a whole mix of different types of approaches to providing funding. Mass consumer appeal is an issue, I think, and that is an issue that is related to those first three topics there. We feel that, you know, the government must set the stage, kind of show the direction to go, whether it's in providing incentives for the vehicles, buying the vehicles themselves, helping put in infrastructure, or putting in your own and making it available to the public, those sorts of things. Because once that happens, the commercial industry and the retail public will eventually follow. And it's not on here, but we've always got the chicken and the egg. Nobody's going to buy a vehicle without a fuel station. Nobody's going to put in a fuel station unless there's vehicles to fuel off of it. So once again, we're back to the scenario where I try to get all those people in the same room to coordinate their efforts and try to make something happen.
Well, I think it's quite an exciting stage in the state of our economy and the state of transportation, the ability to be on the breaking edge of technological advances and bringing that to the public and the whole realm of how that affects our environment.
Mm-hmm.
It's very exciting. I really appreciate you coming this morning.
Thank
appreciate
you.
The opportunity to drive the vehicles yesterday. And
right. We appreciate the opportunity to come speak with you as well.
First-hand look at some of that technology. It's really exciting. I appreciate you coming today very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted you to know that since the time I was a little tyke, my father has been telling me that hydrogen was the fuel of the future, and that I would see our autos powered by hydrogen. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure he's in his 80s now. I'm sure he'll be very interested to find out that I actually got to drive a vehicle.
Great. Hopefully you got your picture taken then.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. We are going to move next into House Bill 3946, which is our alternative fuel tax task force bill. That'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3946. And John, can you quickly give us an update on the bill?
Yes, Chair Starr, members of the committee. As a reminder, this is your second hearing on this bill. You have before you House Bill 3946, which creates a road user fee task force. It authorizes Oregon Department of Transportation to establish pilot programs to test alternatives to motor vehicle fuel tax. It becomes effective on 91st day following adjournment, signee die, scheduled to sunset on January 2nd, 2010. Since we've had our last hearing on this bill, members, you should have before you a dash one amendment that's very simple on the face of it. It just changes the name of the task force, which was supposed to be the original name in the first place when the bill was drafted. It changes from motor vehicle fuel tax task force to a road user fee task force. We may have a revenue impact. We do not have a statement yet on that. You have, since this first hearing, received a fiscal statement. You should have that before you. And I'll defer to the chair because he has a plan regarding the fiscal statement. Thank you, Chair Starr.
Thank you very much. Randy Tappe. Here he comes.
Good
Welcome.
Morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Are we ready anytime?
You're ready anytime. Introduce yourself.
Perfect.
And you may proceed.
Chairman Starr, thank you, and fellow members of the Transportation Committee. My name is Randy Pape. I'm the president of the Pape Group based in Eugene, Oregon. I serve on the Oregon Transportation Commission, and I'm the chair of the Oregon Business Council's Transportation Task Force. The purpose of my testimony today is to express the Oregon Business Council's support for House Bill 3946. Chairman Starr and Vice Chairman Merkley have worked with the Oregon Business Council Transportation Task Force for the past several months, and we greatly appreciate the leadership on this issue. The proposed Motor Vehicle Tax Task Force, as outlined in House Bill 3946, will help Oregon break the policy gridlock and other transportation gridlock in transportation. The state's basic system of roads and other transportation infrastructure is essential to the future well-being of all Oregonians, and its deterioration is a serious threat to our economy and livability. To break the gridlock, we need to explore a wider range of options than we have in the recent past, and we need to engage in a broader dialogue with the public about our transportation choices. While the business community has been perhaps the staunchest proponent of a modest increase in fuel taxes, it is clear that we need to search further for transportation financing solutions. Even if we did achieve a modest increase in fuel taxes, the increase would be insufficient to meet our needs in the near and long term. A system based on gasoline taxes is likely to become obsolete with the advent of alternative fuel and highly fuel efficient cars. Whatever short-term decisions are made for transportation funding, Oregon needs to embark on a wide-ranging exploration of options to meet long-term needs. House Bill 3946 will begin that exploration. And as Oregon examines alternatives, it is very important to understand customer needs. The public at large does not place transportation high on its list of priorities, and as the recent gas tax referendum illustrates, does not see the need for additional funding now. We need to conduct detailed research on public attitudes. We also need to explore in much greater detail the variety of business needs surrounding transportation. Many Oregon businesses are deeply concerned about the trends in transportation on their businesses. As we learned about the specific needs, we may be able to craft solutions that facilitate commerce and support overall transportation infrastructure. We should also examine transportation needs by region. Governor Kitzhaber undertook such a review several years ago. The time may be right to update it. The proposed Motor Vehicle Fuel Tax Task Force would provide an excellent forum to communicate with the public, test promising new funding ideas, and investigate experiences in other states and throughout the nation. I urge your strong support on this legislation. Further, the Oregon Business Council commits to be an active, constructive participant in this important process. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thanks for your testimony. Deidre, do you have anything to add?
No, just once again to express my appreciation on behalf of the Oregon Business Council for the leadership of Chair Starr and Representative Merkley on this issue, and we stand ready to help you.
Very good. Other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Nelson?
Yes, I just want to thank you. I want to thank Representative Merkley and this team because, I'm from a county that's greatly suffering from, this very issue and massive congestion that's going into pneumonia. And really suffering from economic, you know, development problems because of our road problem, and I appreciate very much your taking initiative to make this happen.
Thank you. Thank you, Randy, for coming up.
You're welcome. Thank you again, and thank you to the committee for your consideration of this important issue.
Craig Campbell and John Watt. Why don't you guys come up together?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of AAA Oregon, Idaho. Over the last several years, dealing with transportation issues, it's very rare that you're able to go in front of a committee and say you're excited about a bill. But AAA is in support of House Bill 3946 for a variety of reasons. The primary one, of course, is that the viability of the gas tax in Oregon is going to become further and further into question. And will probably reach critical mass somewhere within the next 10 to 20 years. It's because of a combination of reasons. One that has been cited more often today is that there will be alternative fuel sources and vehicles in the future that are not taxed, and that will create a problem. But more importantly, Oregon's history of increasing gas taxes has allowed that gas tax to deteriorate because of inflation and because of increased fuel efficiency in existing gasoline-powered vehicles. We lose about 1 cent a year due to interest, and we have not been able to even keep up with that. So that means every biennium we would have to pass a 2 cent gas tax just to keep up, and we know how easy that's been over the last several sessions. So as a result, we recognize that we have to begin to look to an alternative method of funding our highways. The one problem we have is that for most of the alternatives that are likely to be presented, the public just is not willing to support them yet. Part of this is because I don't think they have faith that they have been well enough explored. So there are two reasons why AAA supports this particular approach. One is because it's being done well in advance of when we will actually have to make the change and prevents us from having to make a decision in a period of crisis. So that's the key reason. The second is because you've decided in this bill to take on pilot programs, that allows AAA to involve its members, and I'd like to offer to you today and to the members of the Department of Transportation who will be implementing this task force, we would like to volunteer our members to participate in the pilot projects so that we will have living examples that we can share with our members who might otherwise be skeptical. And so between those two things, we think that this is an excellent direction. There's a great deal of foresight here, and we're very supportive of it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. John.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'd like to thank – my name is John Watt. I represent Jackson County, the Southern Oregon Transportation Consortium. First of all, I'd like to thank Mr. Campbell for giving my testimony this morning. It's always a pleasure to sit with him, although we were on a little bit different sides of this particular issue the last time. I think that it shows that we all have the concerns about the crux of the issue. In Southern Oregon and the region that I come from in the Medford area, we find ourselves growing as many parts of the state of Oregon are. And we don't want to get into some of the problems that we see in some of the other parts of the state and know that we need some solutions, but find after what we went through in the last legislative session that we probably finally came to the end of the discussion about a total reliance on the gas tax. And know that after the election, we heard very loud and clearly the words of the voters in May, and knew that coming back and going after the same kind of a funding increase was probably ridiculous. And I think that the way this issue has been handled, first of all, I think has been very important because it's been minimized this session, and you've been able to develop a piece of legislation that's going to allow for some dialogue where all the issues can be put up on the table and accepted or discarded to come back to this body by the certified smart people, if you will, that don't necessarily have a stake in what the outcome is, but they're issues that you can walk all the way around and have a good look at. So we appreciate all of you in support of this bill. We support this bill from Southern Oregon, and look at it as the first step in a long, long journey. And certainly those of us in Southern Oregon would like to participate and volunteer our clients as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Chris Hagerbomber.
Star, members of the committee, my name is Chris Hagerbaumer and I work at the Oregon Environmental Council. I'm here in support of House Bill 3946. We believe it's an improvement over House Bill 2301, which we also testified in support of earlier this session, because it not only provides a useful venue for studying alternative taxes, but it also allows ODOT to pilot some of those alternatives. OEC believes the costs of the road system should be fully and accurately reflected in what individual motorists pay to drive. This means moving away from using local property taxes for local street improvements. It means charging motorists who use studded tires for the additional wear and tear on the system. It means paying for highway patrol out of driving-related fees, because our police force on the highway is there because cars are on the highway. It means building new roads only when environmental and community objectives are met, and when drivers have expressed their true willingness to pay, not only for building that new road, but for maintaining it over the life of the facility. We hope that the Road User Fee Task Force studies the full range of driving-related costs, including health and environmental costs, and designs a system of fees that accurately and fairly reflects those costs. We also look forward to providing input into the task force and into the design of any pilots that are out there. Thanks.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Bill Pinhollow and Andrea Fogue, please.
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Pinhollow with the Association of Oregon Counties, and Andrea and I drew straws to see which one of us would go first. Andrea won, so I'm going first.
More respect.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you will have our testimony in front of you. The Association of Oregon Counties supports passage of 3946 and the establishment of this road user fuel task force and its challenge to look at alternative funding sources for the future of Oregon. I think we recognize with the presentation that we heard this morning that the existing system is not going to support the system into the future, and I commend the committee for taking on this responsibility. We would also encourage the committee to consider expanding the charge of the task force to include an assessment of the conditions of our state highways, county roads, and city streets, and our bridges, and bring back to the next session a multi-session funding strategy for addressing those significant needs. In my testimony, and I won't belabor this, I'll leave it to you to look at if you desire, is information that we presented not only on the county road system and the dire straits that that system is in today, but also our state highways and our city streets. And we're challenged today to do something about that. We're not going to do it in one fell swoop. It's going to have to be a multi-session, long-term strategy to restore Oregon's system to what it was intended. It is, as I point out in my testimony, the largest single public investment in the state of Oregon, and it's something that we need to protect and preserve. Mr. Chairman, as you consider this bill, we would also encourage committee members to give consideration to the fact that that a large portion of the system that we travel on today is represented by county roads and city streets, and we would encourage the committee to give consideration to adding a county representative and a city representative to this task force. I think both would bring valuable information, knowledge, and experience to this study through the interim, and would, I think, prove to be of value. With that, I would like to thank the chair and the vice chairs and the committee members for showing this leadership and putting this together. As Mr. Watts indicated, the process has to start somewhere, and I think this is a good place for it to start. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Andrea Fogg with the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm following John Watts' example today and thanking Bill for giving the testimony for both cities and counties. Just to echo a couple of points that Bill has made, as you all know, we are facing a critical need for transportation funding. We've come before you many times, and you've seen that picture painted pretty clearly. We think that this task force is an excellent mechanism to move forward with finding ways to address our needs for transportation funding, not only the immediate needs that we face and challenges, but also in the future, as you've seen illustrated this morning with the presentation by the Ford Motor Company. So again, on behalf of cities, I'd also like to thank the committee for their leadership in pursuing this task force and offer that cities would like to very much be a part of this process and in any way we can help with moving forward and finding solutions to our transportation challenges. Thank you.
Thank you both very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. There is a question. Berger.
I appreciate what you said. However, I want to just make a few statements and maybe ask a question. Mm-hmm. The state is in charge of the state system, and that is what they are required to look at. Counties likewise and cities likewise. If you travel around, actually county roads and city streets are in probably worse condition if you wanted to do a comparison to some of the state highways. However, there's a very wide variation in counties and cities that put money into their road system. I would presume that you would be willing, if you are asking for people to be at the table when this discussion takes place, that you're willing to provide the kind of information that would be helpful to people working on a task force that shows which cities have prioritized their roads and spent their money there, and which counties, while some counties have allowed themselves to spend money on perhaps what this task force might consider less frivolous things. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like for both of you to respond to that, because I think that how we spend our money is very important, and there would be some cities that have actually done without some other kinds of things in order to put money into their streets.
Mr. Chair,
can you respond to that?
I certainly will. Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, you make a very valid point. We have to be accountable to the public on how we use these funds, how we've used them in the past, and how we anticipate using them in the future. County officials and city officials alike need to be accountable for that. The last legislative session established a statutory requirement that cities and counties report annually to the legislature on how we use those funds, the state highway funds, but also other funds that are dedicated for roads and streets. And that accountability is important. It's, education is also an important factor, and I think this is an important role of this task force, and I think where city and county officials could assist in helping the task force and the legislature better educate our public on the condition of our road systems, how we finance them, what the real need is, and how we should go about increasing revenue to address the needs that we have. So I agree, accountability is certainly our responsibility, and we would want to provide that to the task force and to the legislature. And education, likewise, is an important aspect of this whole process that we need to join with the legislature and participate in that process.
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, also on behalf of cities, very important that we are educating and being held accountable for how our transportation funds are used. You heard us earlier in the session come before you and give your report on how cities and counties have been using those transportation funds. We'll continue to do that annually, as well as anything we can do to assist the task force with specific information.
One quick follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Also, along with that, rather than just the accountability of the funds that are designated, I think it's very important to know which cities have also matched some of those funds in order to give their highways and road system, rather than just depending on transportation funds.
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, that's a very good point because it really does demonstrate the priority of this issue in particular communities.
Thank you, Representative. There's no one else that has signed up. Anyone else in the room that wishes to testify in House 3946? Seeing none, committee will
work. One.
Oh, sorry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jessica Harris. I'm with the Associated General Contractors. We would like to state just very briefly for the record that we would support this effort or any other effort looking to find another way, in addition to current ways of funding our transportation system. We recognize that long term, the gas tax is not going to be the most efficient way of funding our transportation system, and we appreciate the work of this committee, and we would support any effort in the interim to look at other ways of finding an adequate and fair way of funding our transportation system. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. That will close the public hearing on House Bill 3946. There are additional amendments that are forthcoming, and I would appreciate the conversation regarding the inclusion of a city and county representative on the task force. So with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3946. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 3408. And committee members, it's the chair's intention to use 3408 as a vehicle to move a concept for regional transportation authority. The bill currently deals with taxi cabs. There are some in the audience who have come to testify on the bill in its current state. Since we do have those citizens that have come to the stand today, I will take testimony on the bill as it currently is written. However, I will not move the bill as it currently is written. So with that, I will have the two proponents of the bill as it currently is written come forward and testify. That would be Michael Wilson and Bob Tiernan. Looks like Mr. Wilson might have left.
Yeah, I saw that he signed in, but I don't know. I didn't run across him out there. Anyway, my main reasons that I support
if you could,
this.
If you could introduce
yourself. Pardon me. Oh, yes. I'm Bob Tiernan from East Portland. The main reasons I support this type of bill is because for the increase in the availability of transportation options and as a right to work.
Thank you.
Right now, people are. It's the way the transportation system is set up, you're limiting people to a workshop where TriMet can take them various routes. When Portland is, you know, when the population increases, there's no way that central planners could know, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of routes that'll pop up every day. There's just no way that they can keep up. So you need this on-demand, and the limited number of cabs that's kept limited really doesn't help. As for the right to work, there's a lot of people that can do this very easily, and if you just require basic things, insurance, certification, driver's license, people can form little niche markets, taking people to work, picking them up, and then working at their own job in between. It's not that they're going to be driving around 8 hours a day cruising. There are just a couple of attachments that I did have along with this. One is about a jitney service in Detroit that a lot of senior citizens use, been using it for decades. It's illegal at the time, but the city council, a very liberal city council, doesn't want to touch it. But I think that what they should do is legalize it so that issues like insurance can be dealt with. But it's interesting that they allow it. They just look the other way because they know it's working. Another one is a Portland Development Commission press release from last year, which mentions jitneys and implies other services that Portland is probably getting ready for in any city that's growing. And the last item is an amendment from 2 years ago when this bill was through the Senate that had been added and I think should be considered again, because I think that federal law with the ADC would require it, and it deals with handicapped passengers, so that's an issue that a lot of people would be concerned about, wouldn't want to touch the bill until that's back in. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it. I've got three folks that have signed up in opposition to the bill. My assumption is they oppose the bill as it currently is drafted. The bill as it currently is drafted is not going to move. Does anybody still wish to come testify in opposition to the bill? Seeing none, rise to their feet. We'll close the public hearing in House Bill 3408. I'm sorry. With that, we'll open a public hearing in House Bill 3882. Can you give us a heads up on the bill?
Yes, Chair Starr. Members of the committee, you have House Bill 3882 that creates a separate and distinct fund from the general fund and also a separate and distinct fund from the State Highway Fund for the Oregon Department of Transportation. The ODOT operating fund specifies certain sources and uses of funds and declares emergency effective July 1st, 2001. We have a miniature expenditure impact statement as far as fiscal is concerned. We do have a notice of potential revenue impact. We have not yet received an impact statement on this bill, but we should be receiving one at any time, I'm sure. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Mike?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Mike Marsh from the Department of Transportation. Here to present on House Bill 3882. As John indicated, it establishes a transportation operating fund. We need to do this because we need to account for funds separately from the State Highway Fund. This is a result of the Department of Justice letter of guidance to us indicating the state highway funds are restricted within the Constitution and we cannot use them for certain functions that do not primarily facilitate motor vehicle travel. We do, however, have important services to citizens that we want to use this transportation operating fund for. Certain revenues received by the department come from taxes paid on fuel use for small machines such as lawnmowers, chainsaws, and other similar implements. They do not propel vehicles, so are not subject to the fuel tax constitutional restrictions. House Bill 3882 provides that taxes may be refunded to taxpayers, but if they're not refunded, they may go to the operating fund, and the fund will allow for funding of critical activities such as the work done to get organ donors on driver's licenses, the issuance of miscellaneous permits like events such as parades and bike races, that type of thing. We estimate the net revenues to go to this fund next biennium to be $225,000. Mr. Chair, we think it can help us respond and continue services that are critical and yet stay out of the highway fund. We're open to questions.
This is the bill that relates to the so-called lawnmower fund.
The chair is on the inside of the lingo. Yes, this is what we call the lawnmower fund.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Krupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does this in any way change the current program, Mike, whereby I, as a farmer, if I have gasoline-powered farm equipment, that I can also make application for refund based on using gasoline and those pieces of equipment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, no. The refund is still appropriate.
Okay, thank you.
the situation is that there's a significant number of individuals who don't apply for that refund, so that money then accumulates. They don't ask for the money back.
And if I could follow up on the chair, the reason for that is those of us who mow lawns, et cetera, the amount of time to apply for the dollar or two refund isn't worth it, so it ends up with a little bit accumulating in our fund that we can use for some things that just can't use the highway fund.
Sure.
Jim Brown.
How do you know how much I'm using in my lawnmower?
That too.
Mr. Chair and Representative Brown, it's a good question. Nationally, there are some research organizations that have looked at this subject. We've contacted them and are also, as part of this bill, we will do a survey that asks folks on an average basis, a sampling process, what they expect to be seeking from, especially as Representative Krupp says, those that are more sizable refundees. And make sure that we can make an appropriate accounting. Our estimate right now is at least $225,000 for the biennium. We'll find out more closely. This will certainly cover the $5,000 and $10,000 type uses that we have for the donor program, for the event permits, and that type of thing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike, I should probably ask Kelly this. Is he going to screw up our computer system again? I need to do this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zahner, I think I can say that it's not going to screw up our computer system because we won't have this relating all to one particular area that deals with all sorts of different functions like the permits that are done in other areas. We will be able to look at all sorts of different elements of the department. It won't result in changing the computer system.
Thank you. You made my day.
Good. Further questions, Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Fuel that's used for, I want to say, camping and different activities like that. I mean, how would you ever account for those? I mean, once you're off the road and...
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, it's a matter of looking at national sampling that says people use a certain amount of gasoline on average for their leaf blowers and their lawnmowers and for the different activities. And right now we're doing that on the basis of the national information. We'll do a small sample of citizens in Oregon each 2 years to say, is this about where we think it should be, to make sure that we can answer the constitutional question that says what portion of the state highway fund total receipts of gasoline tax are appropriate to go to this fund. And so that sample will be our way of determining, is this an appropriate estimate? And as the representative's implying, it will be an estimate. There's no way to actually go back in and track it unless we get into very complex systems that Representative Zahner was kind of getting at.
Hold up, please. So at the present time, our tracking of these dollars is done how?
Mr. Chair, in essence, no.
Not done, period.
Not done. We made an estimate for the purpose of the bill.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Anybody else wants to testify on House Bill 3882? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3882. We'll open a work session on House Bill 3882. This bill has to go to Ways and Means. Do I have a motion?
Chair.
Zahner.
I move House Bill 3882 to Ways and Means for the due pass recommendation.
Representative Zahner has moved that we send House Bill 3882 to the Ways and Means Committee with the due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Is there objection? So moved. Close the work session on House Bill 3882. Next, I'd like to go to the work session on House Bill 2139. That will open a work session on House Bill 2139. John, can you give us a brief overview of the amendments that have been drafted on the bill?
Right. Chair Starr, members of the committee, we have again before you House Bill 2139. This is our second hearing within the week. As you know, it establishes and adjusts certain fees for the Oregon Department of Transportation. It declares emergency, takes effect October 1st, 2001. What you have before you is -7 amendment. And if you recall, you should have in your file bill -2 amendment, -5 amendment, and the -6 amendment. -7 processed this bill. It's just more expedient and it's a much smoother transition. Combine all these three amendments into one amendment for editing. And so you have this -7 amendment that includes the combination of -2, -5, and -6. Just briefly for review. -2 amendment creates a $90 fee instead of the $230 for each additional vehicle dealer certificate places and businesses primarily in manufactured dwellings. The dash 5 amendment increases the issuance of fees for various licenses, driver's permits, and endorsements to $8. The dash 6 amendment increases vehicle dealer certificate fees to $1,200, lower fees to dealers dealing in manufactured dwellings, and create 3-tiered renewal fee levels for dealers who annually sell less than 300 vehicles or 301,000 vehicles or more than 1,000 vehicles. Also, members, you do have a fiscal impact statement. However, that is not on the dash 7 amendment. It takes time to do that. But you do have attached to the summary, members, a breakdown DMV provided your committee with late this afternoon regarding this dash 7 amendment. It's attached to your summary. And this bill, of course, came to you with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Thank you, Chair Starr.
Thank you. Thank you, John, very much. Kelly?
Yes.
Will you come up, please? Have you had a chance to review the dash 7 amendment?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kelly Taylor, Department of Transportation. Yes, I have.
And they are what we say they are?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I've checked them over a couple of times, looked at my marked up bill, looked at my memo to Ledge Council. I think it's all there just the way it's supposed to be.
Very good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Very much. Are there other questions for Kelly? Daryl, do you want to nod that the 7 and the amendments that you agreed to? Very good. Thank you. Are there questions of the committee? I move the dash 7 amendments to House Bill 2139. There's a motion on the floor. We do a discussion of the motion. Representative Verger.
I object to the motion. Mr. Chairman, I came here to help small businesses in Oregon and to forward economic development. I realize that the Department of Motor Vehicles has undergone a change and a ruling that has caused them to have to cover their costs. I would have many questions, however, about the time frame that would be used to increase fees, and particularly fees that I believe have targeted businesses that do not have any phase-in program whatsoever. It simply takes, I will talk about commercial driver training school certificates that simply doubled, whereas we have people trying to get jobs and to get these certificates who are unemployed. It is very difficult for me to speak against this because it is being supported by the Oregon auto dealers and also the independent auto dealers, which are involved in probably the most stringent of the fee structure. I do support the theory that we need to pay as we go and it needs to support. I guess the question that I really have and the reason I just cannot support this is, if you no longer can have services except very critical services that must be paid for by the services that you are going to expand, are we continuing to have services that are trying to be paid for on the backs of business in order to continue to do everything that we've done before in spite of a ruling? And, Mr. Chairman, I thank you for giving me this time to express my feelings, and I will be objecting to the motion.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Verger.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Zahner first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Verger expressed my sentiments exactly. One of the comments in my testimony earlier was that the DMV needed more money and they couldn't meet their expenses. Sometimes I think they need to try to be a little more efficient and not just ask for more money from these car dealers. Like, I can just imagine what Daryl went through with those car dealers, because this is quite a raise. And I want to express my feelings. I will I'll vote yes on the bill, but I'll vote no on the amendment.
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I have to concur with Representative Verger today and Representative Zahner, and in my, you know, disappointment that we, you know, have to come to this situation, but based on the Attorney General's analysis, you know, we have to comply with the law. And unfortunately, we need these services. I mean, I think what's happened is many of us have forgotten that, you know, it's like paying taxes. You remember it once a year when you, you know, April 15th rolls around that you're, you know, required to do so. So I think many of us have been unaware of the tremendous costs to provide many of these services. And I'm going to support this bill. I'm just sad that, you know, we weren't aware of this much, much earlier in our life. And it's unfortunate. I regret that there will be an impact on our businesses and citizens. But, you know, if the citizens are requiring the service, this is a user fee for which we're responsible. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments. Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Verger, is it specifically the Dash 6 and the vehicle dealer portions that you're most concerned about?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Is it specifically the Dash 6 portion of the vehicle?
It's in the Dash.
Are there changes that could be made to that would make this acceptable?
I think it would be a phase-in for me. I believe that to suddenly quadruple someone's fees is too much all at one time. I think the goal should be to support the program, as I've stated. I think the other thing is that not only with a phase-in, I'm not sure if when Darrell Fuller testified, he said that in comparison to other states, we need to eventually get there. I look at things like our car registrations, which are the lowest in the United States, I do believe, and yet the public at the ballot will not agree to raise those fees, and yet sometimes the legislative body has to take hold of that and do that. So I haven't answered your question, but that's my feeling on it, and I just really think that a phase in and giving particularly those that have either tripled or quadrupled fees should have an opportunity to phase it in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I think this bill is necessary. I'm generally okay with the Dash 7 amendments. However, there's one part that causes me great pause. It has to do with car dealership license fees from $600 to $1,200. If you sell, as do several of my small dealers, less than 300 vehicles in a year, and you're paying $600, your per vehicle cost is a whole lot more than somebody who's paying $1,200 a year for 1,000 vehicles.
A three-year license, $600 per year.
The point still stands, Mr. Chair. I think there's a very severe inequity here. I don't like that. I will grudgingly vote for the Dash 7 amendments. Everything else is fine in it. I think we need to do this.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Just a comment. The bill as it was drafted instituted a fee for the dealer certificates from $285 for a three-year license. I think it was $958 for a three-year license. And that issue had been and has been the sticking point. The only reason you haven't seen this bill until today is because we couldn't come to agreement with the regulated, those businesses that have representatives in this business, on that issue. It felt like going from 285 to 958 on their members was too high of a jump. So we negotiated and negotiated and negotiated, and it came to this graduated license program as the most fair way to deal with the issue. Be honest, I'm tired of dealing with it. We got an agreement from the representatives in this building that they are okay, and they're not going to they're going to support the license structure that we have in this amendment. Nobody here on this panel is more unenthused about voting for this than I am. The fact of the matter is, if we're going to have business regulations run out of DMV, the cost of the program has to be covered by the regulated. They have to cover the cost. And I've thrown it in their laps time and time again. If you want to keep the fees at the point that they are today, we don't have to raise these fees. We just cut back the program. Get rid of the program altogether, for all I care, to a certain extent. I mean, I'm not advocating that. But, I basically threw it back in their lap. I said, you guys deal with this. Here's the program, and you help craft the program that you want. This is their number from the industry. And so I understand the feelings of the committee, and your chair agrees with you to a large extent. The Attorney General has left us little wiggle room, basically none. We either cut the program or raise the fees. And the regulated, the business interests here, wants the program. They want to be regulated. And so I said, great, and let's figure out how we're going to pay for it. And this is the program by which they've decided that they want to regulate themselves and the fees that they want to pay. Are there members, are there some of their members that are going to call them up and say, what in the world do you think you're doing to me? Absolutely. And are they going to have to answer to their members? Absolutely. Will we have to answer to our constituents that whose fees we're raising? Nope, no doubt about it, we will. Do I like it? No, I do not. And, I want to get this bill out of my committee. I want to send it to Ways and Means. I want them to have their shot at asking DMV the tough questions. I want to give legislative fiscal the opportunity to make sure that the fees that are suggested in this bill are the right places to go. The other fees that we're talking about in this bill this morning, from my perspective, it's a philosophical question. Should the fees that we charge the public to as much as is possible cover the cost of the program? Because we've had legislators in the past that haven't bitten the bullet and haven't voted to raise fees, they've dodged it, we have significant fee increases here. No doubt about it. No question. Stand up, straight up. That's the reality. I think it's a good public policy that if we're going to have programs at the state level and we're going to have fees that we're going to charge them for that those fees should cover the cost. And I think that's a defensible position. Otherwise, I wouldn't be sitting here advocating that we adopt these desk seven amendments and move this bill to Ways and Means. I appreciate the comments this morning regarding these fees and these amendments. I would ask that you support the amendments and support sending this bill to Ways and Means. Potentially, we'll have another vote on this bill on the floor at some point in the future, and all of us will have an opportunity to vote again on something that we don't like voting on. Nobody likes it less than I. Are there any further discussion? Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I support the Dash 7 amendment.
All right.
Any other discussion? Representative Murphy.
Thank you. It's very clear from the Chair's comments how painful this has been to work on. And I commend the chair for having wrestled with this and found it out a compromise. And my colleagues' points are well taken. I think they resonate and concern many of us. But I think at this moment, it's a tough decision. It's time to make it. And I support the chair and the Dash 7.
Thank you. Let's just have a roll call vote, please, on the Dash 7 amendment.
Representative Brown.
Aye.
Representative Devlin?
Aye.
Representative Krebs?
Aye.
Representative
Merkley?
Aye.
Representative
Nelson?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Excuse.
Representative Berger?
Declaring a potential conflict of interest, our family-owned and automobile dealership, I will vote nay.
Representative Donner?
No.
Chair Stoddard?
Aye. Motion passes. I move House Bill 2139 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Can we avoid further discussion? Other discussion? Have a roll call vote, please.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative Devlin?
Aye.
Representative Krupp?
Aye.
Representative Merkley?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Yes.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Warner?
Aye.
Chair Stone?
Aye.
Bill passed. Close the work session, House 2139. Finally. Get rid of this stuff.
Nice job.
Okay. We will have a open a public hearing in House Bill 3876. John, will you give us just a brief overview or highlight of the bill?
Yes. Chair Starr, members of the committee, you have before you House Bill 3876 that establishes an Oregon Turnpike Authority and authorizes authority to enter into agreement with private entities or local governments for building turnpikes. You have attached your summary two amendments. Basically, dash one replaces the language. Well, I'm just going to be brief on it. The dash one amendment is basically a gut and stop from another bill, Senate Bill 816, into this bill. And per your request, Chair, the dash two amendment is just a stop into the additional original bill of Senate Bill 816. And there is no revenue impact on this, and we may have a fiscal impact, but as of yet, we've not received a statement on that. This bill also comes to you with a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. So, Chair's intention, we won't move this bill today, but to amend it and use it as a vehicle to deal with the idea of alternative financing mechanisms, private partnerships kind of things. I'd like to have Randy and Mike come on up, they would. I don't believe we quite got amendments that we quite like yet on the bill. So.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Meriwether Lewis.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Randy Hildebrand, Chief of Staff for Senator Bev Clarno, and to my right is Mike Bonetto, our Senior Policy Advisor. I have asked committee staff to distribute Senator Clarno's priority bill 966. It's got a different, I think it's LC 4242. Basically, that is an attempt to make 816 a better bill. Senate Bill 816 had a relating clause too tight to do what we really wanted to do, specifically remove the toll road language and go to alternative funding programs or funding projects. I would like Mike to kind of go through those changes that we would like to see drafted into your bill. That's what we would like to recommend.
Mr. Chair, committee members, on the dash one amendments, basically I've taken Senate Bill 816 and inserted it here for this dash one. The main concept that we were trying to get with these, with the toll road, one was to basically eliminate the foresight that in Oregon statute right now, you're limited to doing a toll road in these four sites. And we really need to ease up on some of these restrictions if we're going to have any sort of innovative projects take place. So the idea was, one, to eliminate these four sites. I think that is in Oregon statute 383.007. And the other main point was that enabling somebody to come in and to do a toll road, what we want them to do is to, allow them to do any sort of project. And one of that was basically eliminating this 40-year clause, that after 40 years, this toll road would go back to the state. And we thought, if we wanted to attract more individuals to do something like this, then, after 40 years, they might be able to keep that. And that's some discussion that we've been having. The other draft, the LC 4242, that was just given to you, has some similar language in that to 816. It also has some new language in there that I would recommend inserting into 3876. During this session, we have spent a lot of time, dealing with stakeholders and trying to find new, innovative projects, how to fund these. We were, initially we were focusing on toll roads. And then, you know, we had some other information come to us and saying, you know, there are a number of ways to try to look at new innovative financing programs. And we don't know. We don't have all the answers. So what we have come up with in this LC draft, basically taking the Oregon Transportation Commission and having them undertake this study that would be during the biennium, during the interim session. And the commission would appoint an advisory committee on innovative finance to assist the commission and the department in conducting this particular study. And what we feel that basically we would have this advisory committee that could go out and identify these projects, find out, meet with potential stakeholders, and find out if there are alternative ways how we can finance and build roads. Again, we feel like there are so many restrictions right now that we just need to be able to look at other options. We need more tools to look at these options, and we feel that this is a potential tool that we should be able to use.
We did add a couple other sections in here, particularly I think it's sub 4 of section 1, which appears on the second page. It's an exemption from the public disclosure statutes. It was felt in our discussions with the Legislative Council that this is a necessary move. When you're working with the private sector on maybe a multi-million dollar, even a billion dollar project, there is a precedence for keeping some of this under wraps until the deal is struck, so to speak.
Section 5, page 5 of LC 4242.
Correct. I had some similar language, I thought, on the sensitive business language under sub 4 of section 1, but that's exactly right, Mr. Chair.
You're right. Sorry.
And there was also some language about tax-exempt bonds. If you create a creative partnership, public-private entity, you would need to extend to them the latitude of tax-exempt bonds.
Okay.
And with that, I would just urge the committee's support of actually the entire turnpike or toll road, if you will, joint venture project idea.
Concept. Thingamajig. I'm sure. Yes, Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a couple things here that are vastly different. One is to study the feasibility of private-public transportation projects. Well, fair enough. That's one concept. The second is this massive rewrite of the tollway language, which is quite another concept altogether. And is it's not clear to me why that's being tied into doing a feasibility study. Certainly, there's pretty profound implications for policy in this rewrite of the tollway language that would need to be looked at very closely. If the concept is to look at a broad range of ideas, why not stick to that? Other than dive into this tollway rewrite.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I feel that's exactly why we want to take those aspects out of the bill, is so that we can have a broad perspective, if you will, when we look at projects. This existing statute's been in place for a number of years, and I yet to have heard of a project undertaken under this statute. So we really wanted to open it up for more opportunity.
And I think this too plays well with where we're headed to a certain degree with House Bill 3946 as well. Is that, you know, my intent is to provide an opportunity for the Commission to look at a vast array of different ways of financing our transportation system. And rather than keep them narrowly focused on toll roads as perhaps the only alternative, to keep that will still be in the pot, still be in the mix, but to allow them to look at other options as well. Doug Tindall has signed up to testify, and he, I'll just have Doug come up now, and you gentlemen can stay where you're at. We can continue this discussion.
with maybe some more.
Mr. Chair, you're not going to move this bill today?
No, we're not.
Thank you.
Are we due on the floor?
I'll be brief. Chair Starr, members of the committee, Doug Tindall, maintenance engineer for the Oregon Department of Transportation. The testimony that's being handed out is testimony on the bill as it was drafted. I saw the amendments this morning. My quick read, I was happy to hear John describe what they did because my quick read was exactly the same as what he described. We're excited about the opportunity to expand. I think Chair Starr very appropriately describe why the bill gives us that opportunity by moving away from just being able to do tolls and into being able to do those other types of projects. The issue that that's raised in the testimony and occurs with the Dash 2 amendments is about creating a separate turnpike authority separate from the Department of Transportation to do this. Not necessarily a bad idea, but it raises a lot of questions in terms of how federal and state funds would flow to this new entity, how the administration would occur. It appears that you would create an authority here that would not have some of the things that are necessary to build a turnpike, like the ability to acquire land. So that's the concern that's expressed in the testimony. If you create a separate authority from the Department of Transportation, clear how those would be integrated. And that's all I have to say.
Further questions? Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Doug and Mike and Randy. Thank you for being here. I guess, I have a concern for the name of this authority because it seems like it's more a, financing concept, which we desperately need. So I'm going to recommend that we rethink that in the proposed amendments. It's much like the road user fee versus motor vehicle tax, as we started out on another bill. And because I think it restricts the use of financing when we find it to turnpike issues. And Lord knows we need any financing we can find for many different types of modernization. And so that's number one. And number two is a little concern for our turning ODOT into an OHSU quasi-private public entity. And like SAFE, which we've done both of, and I think that if we're going to do that, I think it requires, when we talk about these partnerships in constructing these highways, that we're going to have to look at the overall business plan of doing that. So I recommend that somewhere both of those items be included in the consideration of amendments.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We did consider some of those factors, and the public-private partnership would be on a case-by-case basis by project, and a contract would be signed, and there would be undoubtedly a lot of stipulations there. So I do share your concern with that, but I think we've on the track to deal with that. And on a similar note with the naming of the process, if you will, we've struggled with that quite a bit with ODOT officials and the senator. Originally, we wanted to call them e-ways or, get away from the toll language. Turnpike has certain connotations. We worked on a similar bill where we had public-private joint ventures as the terminology. I would welcome any kind of input on that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, basically what we want is to provide the department additional tools in order to get pavement laid, in order to be able to move people and product as efficiently and effectively as possible.
Absolutely.
We like
and I guess just my last remark, where we talk about this eminent domain issue with Measure 7 here before us, somewhere in this bill, since that is all considered, and we've had vast testimony, we had testimony this week on the access issues of businesses, I think we're going to have to consider that land acquisition issue and treat it differently now with Measure 7 here, or if it is to stay.
I think that's pretty clear.
No.
Just so the committee would know, I intend to move this bill, and Senator Carno's office and my office are working closely with the department and the governor's office to craft a measure that gets to what we want, where we want to go, and we hope to bring that back in the very soon, very near future, so we can move this bill to the Senate.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Merkley.
I would just ask that we get as much as advance notice as possible. I think that in Oregon statutes now, there are a number of provisions that were long-term planning items related to people's concerns about being rolled over by a tollway. And I'm not sure that this is the moment to strip all those out. When we're in the mode of planning for a variety of ideas that might include tollways, that seems to me that's the sort of process that might come back with recommendations or provisions that need to be modified because we have a new concept. For example, the tollway might not be what we think of as a separate road, but it may simply be an additional lane on an existing road, that sort of thing. But this really strips out a lot of provisions in an early manner, and it also has real implementing type of language in it related to bonding authority and so forth that I think has to be understood pretty carefully. So if we're going that far as opposed to just studying this range of options, then I think the committee really needs the time to understand what's going to be brought forward and try to get comfort with it or get questions answered.
I appreciate those comments, Representative Merkley, and have my commitment that as much as is possible that I'll communicate with the members of the committee as we move forward on this discussion. Thank you. I'm seeing no other business before the committee. We are adjourned. Thank you, gentlemen, for testifying.